the Iranians recognize that if they build a nuclear weapon, they will potentially spur a nuclear weapons race in the region. And if all countries or key countries in the region actually build nuclear weapons and the region is nuclearized, Iran would lose a lot of its strategic advantage. Because if you take a look at the map, Iran is a massive country, much larger population than most of its Arab neighbors, or actually all of its Arab neighbors in the immediate terms, except Egypt. And that also has a lot of other conventional military strengths that puts it in a very conventionally favorable position. If, however, Iran were to weaponize, build nuclear weapons, and others would follow suit, then Iran would find itself at parity with many of these countries that otherwise are inferior to it from a conventional standpoint. Tiny Bahrain, that is not even a 30th of Iran's size or population, if they also have a bomb, well, then Iran and Bahrain are more or less at parity. There was an Israeli general who told me that India's biggest mistake was that they tested the bomb. Because prior to testing the bomb, India was 10 times the size of Pakistan. Once they tested the bomb and the Pakistanis quickly followed suit and tested their bomb, then they were equals. And India, to a large extent, had lost a lot of its benefits. The Iranians are well aware of this. This is exactly why the Shah didn't build the bomb, but he wanted to have the capacity to build the bomb if the security environment of Iran changed in such a dramatic way that the cost-benefit analysis of building a bomb would have changed. The one thing that would change that cost-benefit analysis is for Iran to get bombed by the United States. Now, we don't know
Do you think, by the way, do you think that's the reason why Israel never publicly acknowledged that they have nuclear weapons, to keep that ambiguity out there so that everybody else doesn't race to a bomb?
Well, I think everyone knows that they have it, but that ambiguity to a large extent was necessary in order for the Western countries not to punish Israel for having built a nuclear bomb, which in previous decades perhaps would have been a political reality, given the fact that the Israelis were doing something. Not that they ever signed the NPT, but nevertheless, it would create a headache. It was to the benefit of the United States and for Israel and everyone else to pretend as if no one knows whether Israel has nuclear weapons or not.
Well, so along those same lines, though, let's go down that path that you had a second ago. Let's say that the internal dynamics, they say, well, you know what, the Iranian regime, it is going to be, it's the least of the negative things to have a nuclear weapon, so let's go ahead and get one. And now then you say then there would be nuclear parity because others would go. But I mean, that would still be fraught with difficulty. Would the West, would Israel be okay if Bahrain or Oman or Saudi Arabia, which seems to be the closest one that could do it, if they were going to a bomb, how would that dynamic play out? What would that do to the region?
No, I think you're quite right from a U.S. perspective. I mean, this is part of the argument, of course, as to why a nuclear weapon in Iran had to be prevented, because of the risk of the cascading effect and a bunch of other countries getting nuclear weapons, particularly in a region that oftentimes have not had as strong of a diplomatic channels as needed. I mean, the United States and Russia, or the Soviet Union, had nuclear weapons pointed at each other, but also had a lot of dialogue and direct channels. And at one point in the Cold War, a red line was created between the US and Soviet Union precisely to prevent any misunderstandings. But you have a situation between Iran and Israel in which there is no formal diplomacy. There's no, you know, standing channels of communication that are reliable. So the risk of miscalculation is immense between the two sides. So in my view, it's fully understandable that there would be an effort from the United States to prevent further nuclearization of the region. My point, though, however, is that what Obama did was actually much more effective towards achieving that. And what Trump has done now, I think, unfortunately, increases the risk of the Iranians going in that direction. There is still a chance, however. There can be a deal made between the United States and Iran. And here I think Trump is much better than other presidents, because Trump is willing to do big deals in ways that previous presidents wouldn't even dare to dream of, because, you know, the difficulty of getting the bureaucracy to come with you, path dependency, all of these different things just created a situation in which creative thinking never occurred in D.C. And if you brought it in from the outside, it quickly died. But under Trump, you have a very different situation, to his credit. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will always be used or always be used the right way. But in a situation as the one between the U.S. and Iran, that is exactly the type of attitude you need to have to resolve a conflict this long that is so festered and so infectious. The only problem is that he just made his own job which he had a better chance of succeeding at than anyone else, he made it so much more difficult by caving to the Israelis and striking in the first place.
Well, that's what I wanted to go next. It's the elephant in the room is the Israeli aspect, because in large measure, it may not matter what Trump himself wants to do, because there's this wild card out there that has shown that it's been willing to move a little bit to his pressure. But I think that there's some limitations on that, because especially in the months leading up to this, the many of the Israeli folks, especially since 10/7, have just been lusting after finally a 50 once in a 50 year opportunity, as former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Naftali Bennett said, this is a once in a 50 year chance to go after the head of the octopus, et cetera, to go after it. And they really, really want to get Iran, not to just harm them, but to eliminate them from an issue, i.e. regime change. So are they going to allow Trump to have some kind of negotiated settlement? I mean, strong words, but I mean, what do you think?
So that's a very important question, Danny. And this also brings us back to what we talked about earlier on that I wanted to just quickly address, which is, you know, did the strike against Iran pave the way for this diplomacy in Gaza right now, or is it something else? And I just want to go over to something else a little bit quickly, because it's relevant to the answer to your question. I think there's three things that really happened here that prompted Trump to move in this direction of going forward with this Gaza plan, and just frankly surprising a lot of nations by putting this forward. The first thing is something that few people have noted, which is that the French and the Saudis were pushing for this initiative at the UN for the creation of a Palestinian state. It was overshadowed by all of these recognition of Palestine, but there was this deeper effort which culminated in the New York Declaration adopted at the UN with 144 votes. Prior to the September meeting, they were actually supposed to meet in July in New York at a special session. That had to be postponed because of Israel starting the war with Iran. And prior to Israel starting the war with Iran, Marco Rubio's State Department had done everything they could to sabotage that conference and even threaten countries from attending it. But it went forward. It was successful. It was adopted, and it actually added pressure to the Trump administration that they needed to do something on this issue. Otherwise, others would take the initiative and run with it. So that's a factor in the background. Then, of course, you have the most important factor, which in many ways was a trigger, which is that the Israelis overreached. They bombed Qatar against U.S. wishes, to the surprise of the U.S., at least according to the official narrative. And it just brought the entire region together against the U.S. It questioned U.S.
And you're talking about the strike where they assassinate or tried to assassinate the Hamas negotiators who were there
exactly
at the U.S. Request, and apparently at the Israeli request.
Exactly. And the Israeli even had paid the Qataris for all of this. So they strike, they fail, but it shows that the U.S.'s security umbrella, official or unofficial, is really not that valuable, because it couldn't stop Iranian missiles. And now it also apparently doesn't work when Israel decides to attack. And if you're one of these Arab countries that have put so much, in fact, all of your eggs in the American basket, hoping that it will protect you against Iran, but now suddenly out of the blue, it turns out that another country, a close ally of the United States, is actually attacking you and the security umbrella is of no worth whatsoever, then why on earth shouldn't these states start having their conversations with the Chinese? When the Saudis announced suddenly a couple of days after this that they are now in a deal with the Pakistanis, and the Pakistanis are providing a security umbrella or a nuclear umbrella for Saudi Arabia, I think the message was, you know, which country Pakistan is working very closely with militarily? China. So Pakistan is a stepping stone towards China. I think the Saudis were signaling that they're getting serious about starting to have a much more serious conversation with the Chinese about this, which is, of course, something that from the U.S. side is not something that the administration or any previous administration have required. So this ended up creating a trigger in which something had to change. But then there was a deeper issue. And I think you probably know more about this than I do, Danny. But what I observed and people I talked to show that Israel standing in the America First MAGA crowd over the course of the last couple of months have just been plummeting.
Yes.
And for several different reasons, including what happened with Charlie Kirkland, which there's no evidence, at least that I've seen, that the Israelis actually had anything to do with it. But there seems to be a very commonly held view that they may have had something to do with it, to the point in which, you know, Netanyahu himself had to come out and do a video response saying that Israel had nothing to do with it. And I think that ended up creating a scenario in which truly Israel became a political baggage for Trump.
And, you know, that even aside from whether they did or not, that it was certainly confirmed that Charlie Kirk himself had some real clashes with a lot of Israeli people, and he was souring on them. And that by itself had an impact.
Exactly. And that he 48 hours before actually said that he's going to get off the pro-Israel train, or he had lost a lot of donors, etc.
Yeah.
And he was not going to cancel Tucker and others at the request of some of these donors. So there was a break there with some of the key people in that movement. I mean, Tucker already had done so, Steve Bannon, and Charlie, of course, who's falling amongst young American conservatives, was very, very strong. And this ended up becoming a baggage and a headache for Trump. Because he's going into midterm elections, very problematic and challenging in many different ways. And he has this albatross around his neck, which is a Netanyahu government that just keeps on creating problems for him. And as he said to one of the donors from the pro-Israel crowd, my people hate you. What he told Netanyahu, according to what he himself said to Sean Hannity, is you can't keep on fighting the entire world all the time. Essentially, what he's saying is, I can't keep on protecting you and defending you and spending so much political capital abroad and at home just constantly doing your bidding.
Yeah, now, if it's hurting him, exactly.
If it's hurting him, exactly. I'm not saying that this has anything to do with his any passion or empathy for the Palestinians or for the Israelis. This is hurting Trump. Now, we had a similar situation under Biden. This was hurting Biden.
Right.
But Biden didn't care.
Yeah, he might want to have, probably politically should have rethought that, but it sure did come and bite him in the butt.
Exactly. I mean, one of Biden's former officials told me just a week or two ago that, you know, Biden wanted to leave the White House as having been the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history. Why is that a goal? and you know, what's the point of that? Particularly when you yourself, as Biden, has framed the election as the future of American democracy. So apparently you being the most pro-Israel president is more important, according to your own metric, than American democracy. So I think we have to be appreciative of the fact that when Trump's base is starting to become skeptical of Israel and what Israel is doing and the genocide in Gaza, etc., that actually Trump was responsive to it. I'm not saying he's done everything he needs to do or that there's not plenty of things that he's done that I wish he hadn't done. But at least he shows himself to be responsive to it in a manner that I never saw Biden be, despite of all of the polls and everything else that was happening that show that this would be a disaster for his election and for his legacy.
I want to shift into the second part of what I want to talk to you about here, because all this stuff with Iran basically is a setup for what's happening on the very tenuous peace process going on between Israel and Hamas. And to your point there that you just made up, I want to bring in, here's a video of Steve Witkoff when he was trying to give Netanyahu some love at a recent speech in Tel Aviv.
To President Donald J. Trump.
I had to stop because they were cheering.
But then you tried to thank Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And?
To Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh. Every time you said his name,
they
booed.
Look, that's how they feel. I don't feel that way. And I thought he steered his country through some really difficult circumstances.
People think that he prolonged the incarceration of the hostages for his own political future.
I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that. That's a separate question. I want to answer that last one about whether or not Netanyahu prolonged it in order to use the hostage situation to his political advantage. But that issue right there was, you could see on Witkoff's face on the stage, he's like, whoa, he did not expect that.
And look, if we had a functioning media that was actually reporting the conversations that people are having in Israel, we would not have been surprised that so many people there, in that crowd in particular, who are celebrating the release of the hostages, would be booing Netanyahu, because this has been out in the open for a very long time in Israel, that Israel has completely abandoned the hostages, that Netanyahu pursued a prolongation of the war for his own political reasons, and that a very critical element of Israeli culture had been either changed or attempted to be changed, which is that, you know, historically the Israelis have gone out of their way to make sure that every hostage, every soldier is released, including in the case of Gilad, I think his name was, 1,000 Palestinians were released for his release, to a situation now in which the Hannibal Directive was ordered, meaning that the Israelis actually would kill their own people in order to prevent them from becoming hostages. I mean, those are two extremes in terms of your attitude towards your own people, towards your own soldiers, to your own citizens. One in which it's better for you to have you dead rather than being a hostage or be kidnapped. And the other one in which they would move earth and ground just to save one single life. And clearly that is not a smooth transition, and a lot of Israelis are completely against it. And this is part of the reason why they blame Netanyahu. Many of the deals that have been struck or have been considered, including the one that was formed thanks to Trump's pressure in January, the ceasefire, was on the table back in July of last year. But then Netanyahu was not pressured by Biden to accept it, so he didn't. And during that course, we had several hostages being killed. And it could not come home alive. And of course, we have thousands and thousands of Palestinians completely needlessly butchered by the Netanyahu government. So it's no surprise that a lot of Israelis would be booing Netanyahu. It's a surprise that our media is so bad at covering this that we are surprised by it.
Right. And that kind of leads into the next comment here about this peace process. So there's one thing about being optimistic and kind of laying out a positive stone. And then there's another thing of like going, okay, what planet are you talking about here? President Trump, in this next comment here, and this also came earlier today, says that thank goodness we have peace in the Middle East for the first time.
Right now it's in the hands of others. You know, we have 59 countries that agreed to the deal. We have a peace in the Middle East for the first time ever. We made a deal with Hamas that, you know, they're going to be very good. They're going to behave. They're going to be nice. And if they're not, we're going to go and we're going to eradicate them if we have to. They'll be eradicated. And they know that. And you have Israel would go in 2 minutes if I asked them to go in. I could tell them, go in and take care of it. But right now, we haven't said that. We're going to give it a little chance. And hopefully, there will be a little less violence. But right now, you know, they're violent people.
Is there really going to be a peace here? Because it's hard for me to figure out what Trump's actual play is, because I don't know if he just wanted to placate his base because of the issues you mentioned a second ago. But if he did, that's not going to be a permanent one when you're literally demonizing the Palestinian side. You just mentioned a lot of the Palestinian people who have been suffering so egregiously, and kind of wrapping all that together with Hamas, but it doesn't seem to be very clear. And nowhere did he say in any of those comments anything negative about what the Israelis are doing and some of the ways that they've already broken the ceasefire. What do you make of this?
So, look, I think there are plenty of reasons to be highly, highly skeptical. In fact, I was just in a big conference on the Middle East in Europe with several senior officials from many of these different countries. They're all very skeptical. They don't know if this is going to work. They're all, however, extremely supportive for a very simple reason. For the first time, the United States is putting pressure on Israel. And it is doing so in a manner to make it as difficult as possible for the Israelis to undermine this agreement, similar to the way that they undermined and broke the ceasefire back in January, that lasted for 2 months instead of actually going to phase two and phase three. It's not because they have huge faith in the idea or the proposal itself. It's because if the United States finally is willing to put pressure on Israel and change the trajectory of the region, they have no choice but to support it and invest in it as much as they can in the hope that it perhaps it will eventually lead to a more detailed plan that can work. But they all know Trump is rather impatient. He doesn't have the patience for extensive negotiations that works out all of the details. He wants to be able to quickly say he struck a deal, he made peace, and then leave the details to be addressed later on and worked out. But by putting his entire political capital and name behind the deal, which was an Arab demand, they wanted to make sure that Trump really owned this as the only guarantee they have to the extent that it is a guarantee, that the Israelis would now be on a better behavior and be worried about undermining the deal, because if they were to do so, they would be directly contradicting and challenging Trump. Whereas with the previous deal, as much as he took credit for it, he didn't do, you know, this whole big event in Sharm el-Sheikh and getting 50 heads of states to come there and putting them all on stage together, etc. And this very excessive manner in which he took credit for the deal and put his own name on it. All of that is there as a buffer against Israeli attempts to sabotage the deal in the absence of better guarantees. But for the first time, seeing that Trump was willing to put pressure on the Israelis is the key reason as to why these countries, despite not having high hopes, are willing to put full investment into this approach.
Well, I can certainly understand that from a certain perspective, but then we got to see, you know, how much of an opportunity is there really? And I wonder if you could talk, whether from your sources or just from your knowledge, that there is a certain line of thought that says that the Israeli government, the majority of the Israeli government, considers it anathema to do anything besides continue until a methodical military conquest of the Palestinian areas. And that probably includes both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and that they want the ceasefire to fail and they want it to be somebody else's fault. And they want to convince Trump that this isn't going to work. Can they be restrained?
They can, absolutely. But it will require consistent pressure from the Trump administration and from the United States. What we have seen in the past is episodic pressure from the United States, which can bring about a ceasefire, but not sustain it. If we want this to work, and if Trump wants this to truly be the peace deal that he's already touted it as, well, that will require consistent pressure. He can never let his eye off the ball on this one. And of course, it's easier for the Israelis to sabotage it than it is for Trump to sustain it, because as the president of the United States, he has 100 other responsibilities, including a bunch of other foreign conflicts that he has to pay attention to, whereas Netanyahu can be laser focused on this issue. Mm-hmm. And his cabinet minister can be laser focused on this issue. But we've already seen a couple of things in which, you know, the Israelis have killed quite a few Palestinians already. It's just at a lower level than it was before, but certainly not what it should have been if this was a ceasefire that they truly honored. But that we have seen counter pressure from the United States, in which they have privately made it clear to the Israelis that they know what happened, and it wasn't what they said that was a Hamas violation, but this was actually something the Israelis themselves had done. It's that stronger and sustained that is the only way of making sure that this actually can last.